is the last time we meet for Yom Kippur. There's an idea in the whole happening of Yom Kippur that's very unexpected. Let's try and work on this. You see that if you look at what we do in Yom Kippur, you'll see that there's an area we focus on that's very surprising. But before we even say what it is, let's try and understand that obviously what's happening on Yom Kippur must be the heart of what we are. The heart of what a person is being decided on Yom Kippur. That means what a person's going to be for the next year, alive or not, that's being decided. That's in the balance now. So we can't afford any frills. Now obviously what a person's working on in Yom Kippur must be the core of what a person is, not each individual. And us as a nation, it must be that what the Jewish people are working on, what we're agonizing over, where we're trying to achieve life and avoid the opposite, it must be that that must be the issue that goes to the core of what life is and what a human being is. Can't be any other way. And therefore, if you could pick out the central idea of Yom Kippur, if there's of course the central idea is Shabbat, working on yourself and trying to reach perfection, wipe out mistakes that a person made in the past and that we did as a nation. But which area do we focus on among all those areas that are the tithers, the drives that we have, the drives to pleasure, the nonsense that we get involved in, which is the area that we focus on? If we could pinpoint that area, we'd have an idea that that must be the core of what a human being is. And it must be there that survival, must be the relationship to that area that determines whether a person survives or not, spiritually and literally, physically. And the unexpected or surprising thing is that you'll see that the heart of Yom Kippur, there's a focus on the relationship, the sensual, intimate relationship between man and woman. Let's try and understand this. Again, this is a subject that nothing could be more important than this, and that's why we have to talk about it. But unfortunately, the kind of subject that's not easy to discuss, especially not here. And therefore, we'll have to talk in hints when we're close to the core. But I think we can, with a little effort together, we can work out something very deep. So understand that there's a very deep subject here, very deep. Certainly can't be plumbed in one discussion. A person has to think about for a long, long time. And then there's a practical side that we're going to have to take home, a message, at least the practical message. You know, think about the deeper thing later. Let's see if we can work both of them together. First of all, you see that on Yom Kippur, obviously, you go through areas that touch on the intimate core of the personality. When you go through the vigor of the confession, you'll notice that many of them over there deal with that area that a person has perverted. Relationship with women, looking at women, looking at each other, even looks, even just being alone together, even if nothing happens, no particular sin. We examine all the periphery of this issue and we confess it and we bring it out. But you'll see it's much more than that. If you look at the Torah reading on Yom Kippur, very surprising. If you had been given the job of deciding what we read on Yom Kippur, choose something appropriate to the day. So what would you choose to read? What would you choose as appropriate to the day of Yom Kippur? Something about fasting or spiritual elevation maybe. Now, there are a lot of things you might have thought of. But no, we read the parsha in the Torah that deals with the forbidden sexual relationships between men and women. And not only that, but the most perverted ones. Relations with an animal, a man with a man, probably more disgusting. A person with his mother, with his sister, close relatives. That's the parsha we read. That a person not allowed to have a relationship with his mother, with his sister, close relatives like that. The greatest perversions imaginable, we read that on Yom Kippur. Now that takes a lot of understanding. First of all, on Yom Kippur, if any time in the year that a person's feeling less inclined to be heavy head swayed by that sort of thing, then a person's hardly weak, hardly strong enough to stand up during Shmoneh Esrei on Yom Kippur. Let alone have thoughts or be attracted after this area. But not only that, not only is it that he's being warned over here about somebody else's wife or about some other woman who might have an attraction for him, and vice versa, I'm just putting it in the mail, for simplicity's sake, and vice versa. But here he's being warned against those relationships that a person, even the best of circumstances, maybe you call it the worst of circumstances, doesn't have any attraction, doesn't have any affinity. The Gemara says clearly that, and Sheikh Nesis Agdala, we mentioned this in another context some months ago, that Sheikh Nesis Agdala, the great Sanhedrin, they had an opportunity to, there was a time when people weren't coping with the idolatrous yeter, that means the drive in the personality to worship idolatry. We're not going to go into what that means now, but people weren't coping. So they decided to mabatul it, to shecht it, to kill it, to exorcise it from the Jewish people. Fascinating story, I'm not going to go into detail, but basically what happened was they called it up, this incredible body of saints and saintly individuals. They called up this Yetzer, the leaders of the Jewish people, acting on behalf of the Jewish people. They called up this creature, this spiritual force. It says it came flaming out of the Kurdish Kadoshim. It came flaming out of the Holy of Holies. That's where it lives. This perverted drive to spiritual greatness lies in the holiest place on earth. And it's then this deep idea came flaming out, and they killed it. They exorcised it from the Jewish people, which is why we don't have a desire anymore to worship inanimate objects or forces in nature. It's just something we can't relate to now. It's a fascinating subject in its own right. But that's not the point for now. The point for now is this, that after they did that, they decided to continue and take away a man's drive for women. Because it causes so much problems in the world. Many, if not most, maybe nearly all, probably all. Like the secular psychologists say that it's all traceable to that. They're quite right. It's the wrong view and mechanism and understanding and implications and consequences. But they're quite right. That is the core. And that's what we'll try and understand this evening. So they're trying to take away a person's drive, that instinct, that drive, that is the drive for sensuality, the drive for relationship between the two sexes. So the Gemara says this, they managed to do it, they killed it, so they exorcised it, they removed that drive, and they poised with bated breath to see what would happen, and the Gemara says 3 days later there were no eggs. There were not a fresh egg in the whole of Israel. The chickens weren't laying eggs, because you take that force out of the world. So not only don't you have a man attracted to a woman that he shouldn't be, but the chickens don't lay eggs. And the Gemara says, not only weren't they laying eggs, not only, the Gemara, fascinating, the commentaries, they have a question, what do you mean they weren't laying eggs? You mean the eggs weren't hatching, they weren't conceiving eggs. Eggs weren't being conceived, but the eggs that were already inside the chickens, why weren't those laid? You hear the difficulty. The Gemara says the chickens didn't lay eggs. So the commentaries ask a question, but what about the eggs that were inside the chickens? Those were formed already. The Gemara says they couldn't even, the chickens were so cold, they couldn't even bring those eggs to development. Even the eggs that were already formed inside the chickens weren't getting laid. Nothing was moving in the world. So they brought it back. Because without that, there'd be no children. Without that drive, so there'd be no children, no Jewish people, no fulfillment of the Yishuv, the settlement of the world, human beings, human race. So the Gemara says they then tried to bring it back, hop. It means they tried to bring it back in such a way that a man from now on would have a drive in this area for his wife, but not for any other woman. Very good idea. Try to bring that back. Imagine the problems that would be solved if a man had a blinding, all-encompassing attraction to his wife and was completely blind to anybody else. A lot of problems would be solved. So they tried that, and they got an answer. Min Shemayim, it says, Min Shemayim lo yahal bitpiga, papalga. From heaven they don't give halves. That's what they said. You either have it or you don't have it. That's what the Gemara says. You either have it or you don't have it. You have no two ways about it. Either that's part of your Neshama, or it's not part of your Neshama. And then the Gemara says, and this is the part that's relevant to us for this evening, but they managed to bring back this drive. They managed to bring back this drive blind. They managed to blind it. Everyone explains like this. What do you mean they blind it? They managed to blind this drive so that a man, although he has an attraction for women, but he nevertheless has no attraction for his mother or sister. Which is a remarkable thing. If anybody wants to understand this on natural lines, it's very difficult. That means a man might have a mother or sister who is very attractive. Other people might find her irresistible. And he himself were completely flat in terms of his relationship, his attraction towards her. It's a remarkable thing. Remarkable, even if he's been separated from a long time, whatever it may be, that's a remarkable thing. But that's a discussion in its own right. We've discussed it before in various from various perspectives. But the point we want for now is this. We learn from this that it's a natural thing that a person is not. A person can pervert this, by the way. A person can pervert this drive. Many unnatural things in the personality a person can pervert. He can teach himself to have a drive for areas that are abhorrent normally. But nevertheless, a person naturally, the normal individual, let's say, if there are any of us left, doesn't have a drive for this particular area. So let's understand. Yom Kippur is not a time when a person thinking along these lines. At least shouldn't be. It depends if you go to a shul where there are women or where that is a problem, then change shuls. But if that's not a problem in general, a person not thinking along those lines. And not only that, but to warn a person in those areas that are specifically his close relatives, that under the best or worst of circumstances a person doesn't have any drive for, that requires a lot of understanding. What is it on Yom Kippur? The one time when the Jewish people are assembled, like no other time, and they are susceptible and amenable, and their ears are open to spirituality, you take the opportunity to teach the thing that's most important. The biggest spiritual warning you teach a person. You don't pick on the thing that nobody would have thought of, except a pervert, and especially on this day that nobody's thinking. You hear the problem. That requires understanding. It must be that this area is the core of the human being. It must be. It must be that this is the core of the human being. This is the tachlis of the human being. It must be that in this area of pleasure, between man and woman, there must be explained the whole existence of what a person is. It must be that. And it must be that that's what needs correction on Yom Kippur. If that's the core, that's what you have to work on. Yom Kippur, that's what has to be worked on. That area, unexpected, but that's the area. And if you come right in that area, it will filter out into the rest of the personality. Another person will be okay, judged for life, for the rest of the year. And not only that, but for the Jewish people, it must mean that the core of the Jewish people lies in that area. That's what it has to be. That means that the core of the Jewish people, what we are as a nation, must lie in the perfection of that area, of that zone. It must be how we relate men to women, the purity that we put into that area, that must be what we are at core, because we're working on being a Jewish people on Yom Kippur. And our lives depend on it. Well, I hope we'll see together, by the end of the discussion, that the greatest pain that we have now is how far we are. If there's one area that we are dismally distant from any spirituality, that's the area. If there's one place that this generation's broken down, that's exactly where it is. So I understand. Let's add one more dimension here. Perhaps we'll approach it like this. The way to approach it, this question may be in fact provide the answer. The Gemara says a remarkable thing. The transition from Rosh Hashanah, Gemara Chazal, the transition from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, that focuses the explosion of Rosh Hashanah, which we discussed before, as it develops itself towards Yom Kippur, on what human individual is that development based? Which of the great biblical personalities, let's say, as you're aware, I'm sure there are seven great biblical personalities who bring to the world the seven mystical elements on which the world is constructed. Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, Yosef, and David, the seven great pillars, fundamental spiritual pillars of the world. One of them, is the core of the concept of Rosh Hashanah exploding out into the world, existence beginning and moving towards Yom Kippur. Which is it? It happens to be Yosef, Joseph. That needs understanding. Yosef, Joseph? What's he got to do with this time of year? The beginning of the year, maybe Avram Avinu, maybe Abraham, I could have understood. He was a beginning, he started something. What's Joseph? The Gemara says, as we mentioned last time, that it says, Tiku b'chayde shofar, blow the shofar at the new moon, the kesel ayon chagenu, which means at the hidden day, which is the day of Rosh Hashanah, the day of Yom Tov, we blow it. And then it goes on, the pasuk in that Tehillim, you can look it up, in Tehillim it says, and that was the day that Joseph, Yosef, was released from prison. He gained his freedom. And he rose to power over Egypt and made it possible for the Jewish people to survive in Egypt for hundreds of years and prepared the way and supported them with food, saved their lives. That's what happened. He was released on that day. Yosef came into power. That means he came into his freedom on Rosh Hashanah. What's the connection? We looked at it briefly, if you remember correctly, from the concept of the shofar. What is the meaning of the shofar? But let's understand intrinsic to the midah of Yosef, which we didn't do then. What is it that Yosef has that comes into being at this time of year, that's the core of who we are, and that's the reason that we have to focus on this? Now, we have here some ideas that require a lot of effort. Let's see how far we can reach. Chazal put it this way. Kol ma she'ira le'Yosef, ira le'Tzion. That's what it says. Kol ma she'ira le'Tzion, ira le'Yosef. Everything that happened to Joseph happened to Tzion. Tzion. And everything that happened to Tzion happened to Yosef. Which means, the pathway of the life of Yosef, of Joseph, parallels the pathway of the Jewish people as a whole. Tzion, Zion, the concept of Zion. But Tzion, understand well, is not just the Jewish people. Tzion is the focus, which is the core of the Jewish people, that we're always aiming towards Tzion. And it's the temple. The real technical meaning of the word Tzion is actually the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. And it's our focus, it's Yerushalayim, and the Beis HaMikdash. What has that got to do with Yosef? Why did his life reveal all the details of what we experience as a Jewish people in terms of Tzion? Let's see if we can divide this discussion into segments. I'm saying this for a reason. It's because some people are here this morning and I feel bad about going over material that maybe people didn't think would be repeated. But this is just one dimension, okay? So, you can fall asleep for a while. See, we're here this morning. Let's use this to build another dimension. Yosef, Joseph, is connected to Tzion in the following way. First of all, you're probably thinking ahead of me, and you've probably computed the word Yosef, added up the numbers. Yes, those are the Kabbalistic bent. They've probably added up the numbers of the word Yosef, and you'll find it equals Tzion. The name Yosef in Hebrew adds up to the same number as Tzion, Zion. Now you know, of course, that gematria, any two words in Hebrew that add up to the same number, it means they're intimately connected in meaning, they must be the same concept. Because it means that if you could quantify the concept, that's what it means, gematria. It doesn't mean not playing a game. Gematria means that if you could take this concept in the world, and you could bring it down to its quantity, to what it really is, so then you're holding it in the number. If Tzion adds up to the same number, it must be that the Beis HaMikdash, Yerushalayim, the heart of where Judaism focuses, that must be the same as Joseph. That takes understanding. See if we can understand it. The unique characteristic of Yosef, and it's going to be hard to discuss this here openly. Let's see what we can do. The unique characteristic of Yosef is the characteristic of being able, a man, to relate to a woman intimately. That's what it is, in the correct way, with purity. That's what he is. That's what he represents. Let's try and see if we can understand. Yosef is the sixth of the 7 points that we mentioned before. Avraham Avinu is the right-hand side. Yitzhak is the left-hand side. We're not going to go into why now. Yaakov is the middle. Moshe and Aaron are the two kidneys, or the two legs, or other organs. Depends on what's being expressed. But Yosef is the bris. The bris miller, that's Yosef. Tzadik Yesod Olam, the foundation of the world, is called. Tzadik. Tzadik means the righteous control of that area. That's what tzadik means. Yosef is the tzadik. Yosef HaTzadik is called. Avram is called Avram Avinu. Yitzhak Avinu. Yaakov Avinu. But Yosef is called Yosef HaTzadik. Because a tzadik is a man who controls that area perfectly. Yosef is a tzadik. He is the area of the bris. The area where a person translates himself from being who he is into a relationship to being somebody else. And if it's done correctly, what results is the third thing. Child. Or the relationship itself, done correctly, the purity of the relationship is the child. And of course the simon of it, the biological representation of that in the world, is that a child is born. That means that two people relate to each other correctly, with the right, let's say, in the biological reality, when two people relate correctly in purity, right, biologically, then what happens is they repeat themselves. There's such a potent life energy that a new person comes out of that. Two people relate in this area. God, hard to emphasize this enough. Two people relate in this area. And what happens is a third person results in the world. It's not an accident then. You can begin already to feel that it must be the essence of a human being expressed in this area. If it's that area which produces a human being, so it must be the essence of the human being. When a person looks at something, or listens to something, or speaks about something, or does something with his right hand, or does it with his left hand, doesn't produce a human being in the world. If this is the area that produces a person, so that's the area that's closest to the person. We'll begin to understand why the drive in that area is the center of what a human being is, and what we have to do about it. But that's Yosef. That's what his connection is to Rosh Hashanah, to this time of year. Let's try and understand. Yosef is that area. The connection between man and woman, done correctly. You see it in many ways. I'm not going to go into too much detail. Yosef, for example, is one of the 12 tribes. You're aware that the tribes, the sons of Yaakov, who are the perfection of the Jewish people, Yosef is not listed as a tribe. Although he's one of the sons, he's listed as his sons Ephraim and Manasseh. Which means he counts for two. Isn't that remarkable? All the 12 sons each count for one. When it comes to Yosef, he's not in there as a tribe, he's in there as a father of two. In other words, his power in the world is being able to give birth. You see it clearly, couldn't be more obvious. And not only give birth, but double what he was. Ephraim and Manasseh. Those two energies in the world. Ephraim is from the root pri, which means a fruit, to produce fruit. And Manasseh is from the concept of being able to make only fruit. Only fruit. Nothing's wasted of his energy as a father. Nothing gets blasted out into an area that it shouldn't be, which is the sin in this area. But Yosef, you see, is represented by the man who knows how to relate to a woman in such a way that, in such a way of purity, only the right woman and only in the right way, and is in as a father. He's considered one of the Avos. In a sense, in the Kabbalistic writings, he's considered as one of the three Avos, a part of Yaakov, unlike the others. Now, let's take, that's our mainstream. Let's deviate just for a second. What's this got to do with Zion, with Zion? What does it have to do with Zion? Zion is the place, just trying to understand deeply. Zion, Yerushalayim, is the place where the ultimate man meets the ultimate woman. Zion, Yerushalayim, is where Hashem meets us. In Shir HaShirim it says that Hashem is the young husband, and we are the young bride, the Jewish people. And the two meet there. It's no accident that the Chazal say that Zion, the place of the Beis HaMikdash, that place where the Har HaBayis, where the temple stands, is Asra Danashti Shmaya V'Ara Adani, where heaven and earth kiss. Kissing is always an expression of intimate connection between man and woman. Not just accidental, it means just they touch each other there. It means they connect in that way of giving fruit. Heaven and earth kiss, which means the ultimate spiritual dimension meets the earth there. The center of the world, obviously, where the world gives birth, where the world is given birth. Where birth is given to the world, obviously, is from that area of bris, that area of covenant. Covenant itself is the idea of a connection between two parties, which is unassailable and indissoluble. Correctly. So Zion is the place where the ultimate husband meets the ultimate wife. And how do you see it? In the Kodesh Kodoshim. It's difficult to say the words. The Holy of Holies. In the deep writings, it's called Cheder HaMitos. I'm not even prepared to translate it. The Holy of Holies. The holiest place on earth. It's a place where husband and wife meet. That's what's in the temple. You know what was in the Beis HaMikdash in the Kodesh Kodoshim? Two golden angels, one male and one female embraced in love. That's what it was. When we related to Hashem correctly, these golden angels on top of the Aron, they faced each other, embraced each other. When we weren't relating correctly, they miraculously faced away from each other. The Romans, when they destroyed the temple, they dragged this statue in the streets to embarrass the Jewish people. They said, this is what they worship. This is what their effigy, their fetish, is this golden. But of course it wasn't. What we worship, let's say, the focus of our avodah inside the Kodesh Kodashim Sefer Torah, in the Aron, the Luchos HaBris, in the Aron, on top of the Aron, the symbol of bond and union between us, male and female meeting, which is where Hashem meets us and gives life in the world. And the covenant at that point is the Torah. That's what it is. It's a place of meeting. That's what Tzion has to do. You know, there's an ancient custom. You know that any custom of the Jewish people is invested with tremendous holiness. The simplest custom of the Jewish people, if it's a valid custom, is invested with the deepest Kabbalistic depth and holiness. There's an ancient custom that on Yom Kippur, at Kol Nidre, when they bring out the Sefer Torah, everybody tries at least to touch it. To kiss it, at least to touch it. It's an ancient custom. People try all the time, often people. But on Yom Kippur, Erev Yom Kippur, that moment where that electric moment when life and death hangs in the balance, the Jewish people, why? It says because the Sefer Torah is a witness. It's the brief, it's the covenant, and the witness to the covenant. So when the Sefer, at the moment when we make the covenant, when what's being checked out is have we been faithful to the bond, are we living up to what we're supposed to be doing in the world, which is whether you live or die, are you living up to your obligations, have you been a faithful wife? So then, what happens is we try and touch the symbol of the covenant. We try and touch it and kiss it. Think about it. That's what gives evidence against us. That's the testimony, that's the marriage document. The Sefer Torah is the one, the Sefer Torah is the witness, the testimonial that you owe me this relationship. You owe me fidelity, you owe me this loyalty and no one else, you Jewish people. So we take out the Sefer Torah and call Nidre. That's why it stands there, to accuse and to testify. And that's why people try and kiss it. That's Tzion. Understand further. Let's understand further. That's one connection between Tzion and Yosef. Yosef was the man who connected with women correctly. You remember he was the one who resisted the advances, the seduction of the woman in whose house he lived for a year when he was only 17. That was his ordeal. That was his ordeal in life. Yitzchak was bound on the altar. Abraham sacrificed his son. But his ordeal was being placed with a woman, we have to understand this more deeply, and resisting the temptation to relate to her in an incorrect way. This area of controlling that area, son. This area of controlling the way a man relates to a woman in Jewish terms, that area is the core of what a person is. We'll try and understand that more deeply. And its representation in the world, the emotion of this thing in the world, the way it's represented, the way it's seen in the world, the way it manifests in the world is what's called beauty. We discussed this a long time ago. Let's try and just pick out those elements which are relevant to this evening's discussion. The concept of yofi, of beauty. The concept of beauty is the concept of man and woman meeting. It's a woman's beauty. A woman exposes her beauty in that area. That's the real beauty of the world, and the most dangerous. Let's understand. Let's first understand it correctly before we get carried away incorrectly. In Jewish terms, the beauty of that area, a woman's beauty, it says that beauty is with women in that area. The beauty that a woman has, in Torah terms, is the ability to control immorality in that area. That's beauty. Understand well. It's the correct harmonious meeting where there should be a meeting. It's the meeting of opposites. We discussed this when we discussed the Beis HaMikdash a few months ago, for those who are here. Where opposites meet, heaven and earth meet, opposites, stark and sharp opposites, they meet, that's harmony, that's beauty. Where two similar things meet each other in the world, you don't have beauty. Any artist will tell you that. Any creative artist will tell you, where two similar things are put together, you don't have beauty, you have sameness. Beauty is where two opposite things meet and form a harmony. The sharper the difference and the more harmoniously they interact, the greater the beauty. The danger, of course, is that two opposite things being put together can jar terribly. The opposite of beauty. The trick of beauty, if you think about it, you'll see this. The trick of beauty, the chat, the inyan, the tachlis, the thing of beauty, is that two things that are very, very dissimilar fit together and suddenly you see that they're one thing. That's harmony. That's what beauty is. Where Hashem and us fit together, where heaven, the spiritual dimension, and the finite physical dimension, where those two meet, impossible opposites. But those two blend into one. It's an incredible exhilaration of beauty. So therefore, what does it say? 10 measures of beauty came down to the world, and Jerusalem took 9. So it says, Asara kabin shal yofi, 10 measures of beauty came to the world, Yerushalayim took 9.
Why? Because obviously the spiritual beauty is where the ultimate connection is between spiritual and physical worlds. But the correct connection, Hashem and us, the way it should be. Interference in that area is the greatest ugliness. Where the loyalty between husband and wife is interfered with, they're the greatest ugliness in the world. You see it in Yerushalayim. The Gemara says there's a certain nation on earth. These talks are not political, so we won't say names. The Gemara says 10 measures of immorality came down to the world and they took 9. That nation, that's what it says. So what did they do? They built a holy place. In the place of intimate meeting between us and Hashem. Why do you think they did that? A political move? It's not even their holiest place. They've got 2 other cities that are holier. Why did they build a tent? Why did they build a edifice of spirituality in their religion? Why did they put it there? That's where they had to put it. You follow? Why there? Because their middah is sexual, sensual immorality. Is interference in that intimacy. So of course that's where they put it. That's the meeting. That's the place of intimacy between us and Hashem. So that's where they put their place, obviously. Beauty is the control of that area with perfect loyalty and perfect harmony. Where it doesn't jar, it melts into one. Again, it's hard to talk more explicitly than this. Either understand or you don't. So what's the Jewish definition of beauty? The correct meeting of opposites in the correct way. Which means control of the relationship the way it should be. In total obligation, only because I'm bonded to you and because I'm for you and because you're for me. But not because I'm for me. Not because I'm for me. When the two jars, when each one wants to stand separate, that's not beauty. But when I melt into you and you melt into me because I'm only for you and you're only for me, then we can't tell each other apart anymore. And the two things that were opposite now form a third thing, and of course a child is formed out of that. Whatever that child may be. That's the beauty of Tzion. That's the beauty of Yerushalayim. That's what it means, Yofi. That's the Jewish concept of beauty. You see that everywhere you meet beauty in the Torah, you see it's this area. You see it's this area. Control of this area. There's one man in Chumash who's described with a woman's beauty. Yosef, Joseph. Isn't that amazing? Of all the men in Chumash, and they were incredibly beautiful people, the Gemara says Adam's beauty was indescribable. And Yaakov's beauty was indescribable. It was the same as Adam's. And so forth and so on. But there's only one man that's described in the Torah with a word that the Torah always reserves for a woman. That's Yosef. Why? Why? Because he brought to the world control of the relationship between man and woman. Control of that area is beauty. That's Jewish beauty. Where do you see it in Tanakh? Absalom, the son of David, is described with having a woman's beauty. What was he? A Nazir. Nazir is a man who keeps away from physicality. An example in Talmud, in the Gemara, it says there was a woman called Ima Shalom. I think she was the wife of Rabbi Eliezer, one of the Tanoim, one of the great Tanoim. The Gemara says the unusual feature about this woman was that she had children who were so indescribably beautiful, so amazingly beautiful, that people were motivated to ask her why she merited such beautiful children. And she said, because she kept herself gadol mi'erva. That means she kept herself very distant from any hint of immorality. That means she kept herself so covered and so modest that there wasn't even the faintest suggestion of a connection to immorality. And what's the reward for that? Beauty, obviously. Obviously. What do we see? We see that the quality at the core of what life is and what gives life to the world is something intimately bound up with beauty. And the concept of that beauty, the concept of the Yofi is the intense loyalty where all the energy pours, flows, only in the bris, only in the covenant. And not any of it is wasted anywhere else. Any disloyalty at all. Only the loyalty. Total indissoluble bond. That's what beauty is. And anything else is the greatest ugliness. That's why we as a Jewish people, that's why we guard that area so intensely. That's why we're so extreme in that area. We'll have to talk about it in more practical terms. That's why we guard that area. And that's why we struggle so desperately against the Western world, against the secular world that we find ourselves in. What's the core of what they are? What's the core of this culture? That's what it is. And what's it displayed as? The greatest ugliness and the greatest nakedness. What makes the world go round? You have to understand this. It's not just a desire for a pleasure like other pleasures. There's plenty of other pleasures in the world. People who smoke will tell you that a cigarette's a great pleasure. Or people who eat will tell you that. So there's things that are pleasures in the world. So go look in culture, go look in secular and Western culture, go look for the representation of those pleasures. See what you find. So you'll find books. Probably you'll find a book or two here and there about the pleasure of smoking. Probably. Somebody writes a book about it. I don't know. About the pleasure of eating and how you can do it this way and that way and get involved in every angle and niche and nook and cranny of it. You'll find books probably. But the connection between man and woman? What else is there? There's nothing that sells that doesn't have that. The library's written about that. You follow? It's hard to be more explicit. I mean, Did anybody write a book ever about every possible way that you can get pleasure out of a cigarette? It's difficult to. But that, you see, it's the core. It's the core. That's what everything goes around. And that's the opposite of what we are. That's exactly the opposite. That's why we're the core. The core of what we are, the center, the nucleus of what we are, is control of that area. And the center of what they are, what the secular world is, the anti-Jewish world, the center of what they are, what makes them go around, what everything's focused on, is that area, obviously. Let's try and understand it a bit further. Let's understand. What did Joseph do? What did Joseph do? Let's understand this. So he represented that thing. But a Jew doesn't come to the world to bring a thing to the world or represent it. He comes to put that power into the world and to give it to us, to teach us how to use it and to give us the ability. That's what he comes to the world for. Avraham Avinu came to teach sacrifice. He came to teach love and sacrifice. So because he did that, we're able to give our lives for Hashem. The reason that Jews by the million have been able to withstand torture, even little children, women, incredible tortures for many centuries, and die by the million for Hashem, is because there was a man who could do that. The difference is, when a person does that, they don't put it into their seed. They don't put it into their children. But when you're a father, when everything you are is a father, then everything that your child is what you did. But understand it. A person who does something today, his child won't represent that thing. He will, actually, in a faint way. But in this explicit way, everything you do is represented in your children. But in this way, in this deep way, what Avraham Avinu did, every flicker of an eyebrow, of an eyelid that he experienced in his life, is the Jewish people. That's why it took such amazing pains to control every flicker of movement, everything that he did, every thought, every flicker of self-expression. He took such pains to control. Because everything that he did is what became the Jewish people. It's all distilled into the seed that flows into becoming the Jewish people. Yosef, the essential father, Joseph, the one who is the father, he's entirely translated into the Jewish people. If there's one characteristic that a father generates, something that a man does in his life, that becomes the core and essence of what his child is, that's what Yosef did. Let's understand what he did. So it says like this, Chumash and the commentaries, the Gemara says the following. What happened to him? Let's understand. He was a young boy, he was 17. He was sold by his brothers. And he got into a certain difficult situation with a woman. That's what happened. He was in this man's house. He was head of his household. He could come and go as he liked. And it so happened that the woman of the house had an attraction for him, which is beyond expression. Beyond expression. Again, we have to don't have the time to go into it, but just briefly as we can, you shouldn't think that this was a crude expression of physicality. There could be nothing further from the truth. Yosef was brought up in Yaakov Avinu's house. He was brought up in a house where every movement was controlled. He was brought up in a perfection of spiritual refinement and sensitivity. The last thing that would have appealed to him was a woman who was attracted to him physically. That would have been the most debasing experience that he would have, his heart would have sunk within him at such an experience. Understand this, not the way we think. Not we who failed already in this area. He was a perfection, he had perfection, and this was his characteristic. Not only were all the children of Yaakov perfect, but that was his particular mastery was this area. So the last thing that he was going to fall victim to was a woman attracted to him physically, trying to seduce him. And of course it has to be understood on the physical level also, but let's try and understand some depth in it. But the concept is this, that the attraction between them was of a totally different dimension. The attraction between them, probably on a physical level, there was an attraction that we can't begin to describe. But not only that, what made him tick as a human being was what attracted him to her. It says in Mephoshim that they had a prophetic vision. The two of them had a prophetic insight. She certainly had an insight. She was on a level of prophecy, this woman. She could see that out of the two of them would come tribes of Israel. She could see that out of the seed of the two of them would be born one day the greatest holiness in the world. That's something you could attract Joseph with. A crude physical few minutes wasn't what was going to attract Yaakov, a few minutes of pleasure. What was attracting him was the intensity that she put in to the drive that she had for this relationship, because she could perceive that she was right about it. She was quite right. Chazal say, other thing is, these kind of prophecies are vague and she couldn't see the details. The details were that a daughter of hers later married Joseph. He was given a certain woman to marry, and she bore him Ephraim and Manasseh. So it actually was a seed of this woman, only not the way she thought. She couldn't read that detail. But she, imagine the temptation. Here he was faced with a woman, he was unmarried, she was a married woman, that was the problem. But here he was faced with a concept, and he could feel the electricity, and it was correct. You didn't tempt him with something that was false. He wasn't blind. You tempted him with something that was electric and powerful. And out of them would come this reality in the world, and in fact it did. That's what made it irresistible. So what happened? For a year she tried. It wasn't a brief ordeal. It wasn't a few moments of thinking twice. For a year she tried, with everything in her power, to put him through an ordeal that no man's ever withstood besides him at that level of intensity. And again, and again, and again, and he faced the ordeal again, and again, and again, and again, and he resisted it every time. And every time he resisted, he built into himself as a human being the ability to control that experience. And therefore, every Jewish child born, the core of his existence now, from that generation on, the core of the existence of a Jewish child is tremendous energy in that area and tremendous potential to control it. That's what we are. That's what we are as a Jewish people. The core of that is how we relate to Hashem. Tremendous energy. We give our lives for it, because that zone is where life is formed, and we'll give our lives, we'll die rather than do anything else as a Jewish people. But because of Yosef, because of what he did. Finally, what happened was there came a day when it was irresistible. There came a day when everyone was out of the house. He was alone with her. She tried in a more powerful way, and finally he was about to fail. About to fail, about to fall, the Gemara says. Almost failed. There was a moment when he almost couldn't hold himself. The Gemara got an amazing discussion. He dug his nails, it says. He dug his nails into the ground. Much more that I can't go into now, much too intimate. But he dug his nails into the ground. You have to look it up yourself. In order to withstand it. And finally, he was unable. And in that instant that he gave in, he saw his father's face at the window. A vision, an image of the face of Yaakov. And it gave him the strength to suddenly realize. And he ran out. And she held onto his cloak. And he ran out naked. And the Balei Musa learned from this how powerful this area is and how seriously a person should take it and what it means to run away from sin. The Balei Musa also, he could have gone back and fetched his coat. He was a man. He was stronger than she was. He could have walked in and politely extracted his coat from her hands and walked out in a dignified fashion. If he really wanted, he could have run to his room on the way out and put on a sheet at least. But he didn't do that, because fleeing from sin is too serious. Even though it put him in the incriminating, compromising situation, which it did, and he was put in jail for 12 years. That's what he paid for it. He escaped with his life and he was put in jail for 12 years because of that. But because Yosef did that, and he gave that, and he was prepared to give everything for that amount of control in that area, so Yosef became Yosef HaTzadik. That's why that was his ordeal. And he gave birth to a nation of people who make fruit, who put fruit out into the world, who do have relationships and put out children, and the kedusha of a relationship in the world. We don't avoid that area. But we do it only in the right way. That's what the Jewish people is. Only in the loyal place, and only in the correct way. And never spend any of it, any of that energy, which is a person's life energy, anywhere else. Now, let's understand the next step. What did this lead to? What did this lead to? Because I'll say this. Because Yosef, listen carefully, because Yosef was able to control himself in this area, and taught himself, and generated himself this amount of self-control, so it says he put that into the Jewish people. What happened? The people born from him, the people born, the Jewish people, then came into the world after Yosef. He prepared the way for them. He prepared Egypt in a way that could withstand, so understand carefully. He prepared Egypt in such a way that they could stay alive. Do you understand this well? On a physical level, it means that he took a country, he took an area of the world where there was only famine, and he provided food so that the Jewish people could come to Egypt and they could survive. But you have to understand much deeper. What Yosef was a person who took the area of the relationship between man and woman. He took the part of the world where there was a famine of that, and he prepared the country so the Jewish people could survive. You know, Egypt is called Erva Sa'aretz. Erva means the nakedness of the world. It means worse than that, but the nakedness of the world. That's what Egypt was. It was the place of the greatest perversity and immorality. That's what Mitzrayim was. The one place that was the ultimate test for the Jewish people who guard morality in that area. That's why they were sent there. That's why they were sent there. But they had to be prepared to go into a country of the greatest immorality on earth, where the force of the culture... You understand today well, Egypt was much more intense. It was the prototype, the original of today's society. The creation of this kind of society, where immorality is what makes everything happen. They had it as an ideal. That's sort of the essence of immorality. It says in the plague, as I mentioned here before, in the plague of the firstborn, it says that when the firstborn died, nobody who should have died, died. All sorts of unexpected people died. Because actually, unknown to all the people, those weren't firstborns. The husband didn't know that somebody else in the family was a firstborn. His wife had it from somebody else. And she didn't know who was his firstborn. And then the truth came out. People died all over. It wasn't the house that somebody hadn't died. It wasn't the people they thought. That's how deep and rife the immorality was. So it was a place of tremendous perversity. And that's where the Jewish people had to go. Because to become the Jewish people, they had to be born in the place which is the fire, the forge of the greatest immorality, and learn how to control it. It's no trick controlling it when everybody around you is doing fine. It's no trick. Jewish people living in a place where everybody relates to that, and a person wouldn't look at a man who would even suggest, who would look at a woman in the wrong way. So it's very hard in such a society. But you go into a place where that's the norm and that's the ideal, and then come out pure, that's what the Jewish people had to go through, because that's who we are. So what happened? Yosef went through that incredible ordeal to prepare his progeny and the Jewish people and the place in such a way that we could survive in that ordeal and come out the way we are. What happened? The Jewish people grew up in Egypt, and it says the following incredible thing. For 210 years they were slaves. 210 years they were slaves in Egypt, and it says there wasn't one example of immorality. The way Chazal put it is, Achas Hoiso Uprisun Akosut. There was only one example of a Jewish woman. You realize, of course, the strength here is Jewish women, not Jewish men. It's Jewish women who put the strength into the world. It's Jewish women guarding this area. That's what it has to be. That put the strength into the world, as we've always said. There was one case of a Jewish woman who was careless, and she ended up having an immoral relationship with an Egyptian. Only one, and the Torah embarrassingly points it out to show you that that was the only one. And that was a mistake. Because he impersonated her husband, it says. Her name was Shlomis. She went around, she was too friendly with people. She greeted people. In case you think that we're too, in the frum world, too extreme about how we are cautious about the way we look at women and speak to them and greet them and won't be alone with them in any way. This woman was a little too friendly. That's what it says, Shlomis. Her name is Shlomis Bas Dibri. Dibri means to talk a lot. And Shlomis, she greeted people. So an Egyptian notices her as he shouldn't have. And of course he had no chance of having a relationship with her, with a Jewish woman. They would have died. But he impersonated her husband and she didn't know, and it happened. And because of that, a string of events occurred. But that was the only time. Now, think about that for a second. 210 years of slaves. Listen carefully. Let's understand well. There's probably no greater credit to the Jewish people than this. What forged us, where we became the Jewish people, was in 210 years of slavery, where there wasn't a single incident of immorality. Let's understand this well. Here was a country where the norm was immorality. That is, an Egyptian man who had power over Jewish women, as they did. That was his norm. That was his norm. The Jewish women were tortured. To understand carefully here. The norm of the country was immorality. Not that they had a chiddush for them, that an Egyptian man, you know, woke up with a bright idea one day that he was going to lose control in this area. That was the norm. That's what he lived for. In that environment, the Jewish people, Jewish women, let's be specific, the Jewish people, Jewish women, were imprisoned and tortured in such a way that they had no option. They were smashed. They were tortured. They were butchered. They were slaughtered, emotionally and literally and physically. It says that the Egyptians tried to torture them to break their spirit in such a way that they gave the men women's work to do, and they gave the women men's work to do. It's not only that they gave each person a load to bear that he could bear, they gave him specifically a load that he couldn't bear. So understand that. That means here, you just put ourselves in the picture. Here's a Jewish woman. She's working for an Egyptian. She's his slave. He's torturing her. He's making her do a man's work. He's torturing her. All he's interested in is an immoral relationship with her. She's a Jewish woman from a people. She's been born in slavery. This is not a Jewish woman that has 1,700 years or 19 or 3,300 years like we do of prideful history of Jews who've died for this that she can look back to. There's never been a Jewish people before. What does she have as a cultural memory? There's no Torah in the world. After all, what's even her command not to do this thing? Where's her command? Where's her mitzvah? Torah hasn't been given. Where's her mitzvah not to do this thing? She doesn't have that in her consciousness. She doesn't have a memory. She's born as a slave. All she knows is pain and suffering. And look at the gain she could have. Look at the gain. Look what she could gain out of this thing. Imagine what she could do for herself and her family if she'd given to this thing. And that repeated itself millions and millions and millions of times over and over. Can you imagine any nation on earth withstanding that? Could you imagine any people living for 210 years in slavery where the total object of the culture was sexual immorality? For 210 years, can you imagine anybody living? Could you imagine a nation living for 210 seconds? Would any nation on earth live for 210 seconds without one event of such an immoral nature occurring? Are people without a Torah yet? Just a Jewish woman's consciousness of what's right and what's wrong? That's what they did. The Chazal say, you know where that power came from? Yes. Because he was able to control himself in such an unreal way, he put the power into the Jewish people to understand, to withstand such ordeals in an unreal superhuman way. And that's what they did. They survived like that. But you know what? That's not where it ended. It didn't end in Egypt. When the Jewish people got out of Egypt, they survived another 3,000 odd years, 3,200 odd years of existence among nations where that was the norm of the culture, of all cultures around us, whichever side of period. Never gave in. Jewish women throughout the centuries would die rather than give in to anything like that. The only time it broke down is us. We failed. We, our generation, the last 50 years, 100 years, if you even look if you even wish to make it, let's understand carefully, you look at the South African situation, Just look at our parents' generation. Look at our grandparents' generation. Our grandparents, had they been exposed to what's happening in the private lives of this generation, they wouldn't have believed it. Our great-grandparents, certainly. 100 years ago, the Jewish people were a people full of Tahara and Kedusha. Any ordinary Jewish woman didn't need any understanding or learning. Anywhere in the world, no matter what circumstances she was placed in, Jewish children died rather than get involved in a possibility of anything immoral throughout the centuries. There's a famous story. It helps to put it in personal terms. It's a famous story, even brought down by the non-religious authors, by the Yiddish writers, of a Jewish girl, a young Jewish girl, 17 years old, in a pogrom in Poland, 1700s. The Jews were being butchered in town. The women were being raped. And they were being pounded and bludgeoned in every way imaginable. So the goyim took a Jewish girl of 17, and they tied her hair to the tail of a horse to drag her through the streets. So she'd be pounded to a pulp by the cobblestones. And as they were about to start dragging her through the streets, she asked them to stop just for a second. She had one request. What was the request? She found an old passerby, an old lady, who had long hairpins in her hair. She took the lady's hairpins and she pinned her skirts to the flesh of her thighs so that during this ordeal she shouldn't be exposed. That was a concern. That's what Jewish women are. But we failed in this area. We failed. In the last 100 years, we can't speak proudly about this area anymore. But Yosef's koyach was that he put that power into us that it could last until now. That means from 3,300 years ago, a young boy of 17 understood this area as only a Jewish woman can understand this area. And he withstood that kind of an ordeal over and over and over, intensified again. And he brought himself to a point where for 210 years, without anything at all going for them, they could resist it. And the power could still be so great that it could generate pulses throughout history that could reach until 100 years ago, where the Jewish people never got involved in anything like that. An occasional aberration here and there. But apart from that, pure Kedusha. What you have to understand is that that's the core of what a human being is. We'll try and understand a bit more deeply why that's the core of the human being, so we can close the circle. Let's not be guilty of leaving out the practical side. Let's start with the practical. Because that's the core of what we are as human beings. Because that's what a Jewish woman is. That's all. That's what a Jewish woman is. It's guarding this loyalty. It's guarding this area of purity and kedusha, of connection with a husband, in this way, that makes the Jewish people what we are. That and only that. That's the life-giving energy that makes us what we are. That's why we as a woman, all together, can relate to Hashem that way, and not be disloyal. It's because we can take this area of the greatest pleasure and temptation to experience this area in a way that shouldn't be, that we can take it and make it obligation. We can take this intense area that draws a person out of obligation into complete freedom. We can use that as obligation and loyalty. That's what makes us Jewish. And that's on Yom Kippur when we're being assessed, when we're being revealed as what we are as a people. That's the area we work on. It's the area that gives life to what the world is, what a person is. Of course that's the core. The practical side of it is that that's why we take that area so seriously. There are few areas that we put such intense safeguards around. Mikveh, for instance. Mikveh. The purity between husband and wife. The mikveh laws. There's no other law. I can't think of another law in Yiddishkeit that's got such infinitesimal detail that we pay attention to. You know, according to the Torah, if a woman goes in the mikveh and the water touches most of her body, if most of her body doesn't have any interference between the water, right? So then it's kosher. According to the Torah. It has to be an immersion, complete immersion. But the Rabbanan, rabbinically, we are fussy about any interference at all. If she's got a nail that's not properly trimmed, if a woman has a hair that's knotted, one hair that's knotted, and the water can't get into that hair, we're worried about the tefillah. I heard from a great mystic in Jerusalem that we're so fussy about this area because of its condition. Where we're fussy is an indication where you see the greatness and the power. But not that fussy that you hear that kind of halachas and shatnas or some other area, Yiddishkeit. But in that area where the power is so great, that's what husband and wife are together, that's what the children will be. So we can't afford a micron of a problem in that area. We take that on for ourselves without being told to. We don't allow men and women to be alone together. I don't want to be guilty of leaving out the practical aspects. We don't allow men and women to be alone together in a way that's not becoming. People have a wrong idea. People think it's because of what might happen. Couple. Man, woman, this area is so powerful. Especially people who are sensitive to life and they know what it means. So they're locked up together in such a way that they're secluded so something wrong might happen. Of course that's true. Of course that's true. Of course it's true. But it's a much deeper idea. Much deeper. The idea of yichud, of a man and woman being alone together, is that's the form of a Jewish home. The form, the tzura, the spiritual representation of what a Jewish home is, of what the world is man and woman being together correctly. The intimacy of being alone and secluded between husband and wife, that area is expressed between husband and wife. We don't want it to be expressed with anybody else. Not because of what might happen. As well as what might happen. Never in this generation, that's our main concern. We can't speak about these spiritual refinements. Today we have to protect ourselves with tooth and nails against the worst unthinkable perversions, which have become the norm. But the real depth of it is because a man who's not married to this woman, and this woman who's not married to this man, that they should be alone together, which is the form of the Jewish home. And these two are not the loyal couple that they should be together. That's abhorrent to the Jewish sensitivity. Not what might happen. You think when some great rabbinic sage of this generation or the last, he rushes to unlock the door, he shouldn't be alone in a room with a woman. He doesn't trust himself. Is it because of what might happen? Is that our worry? Or some great and spiritual Jewish woman who wouldn't dream of doing anything that she shouldn't do. Is that our worry? Are we going to sink to that level? They have the same prohibition. But the prohibition is because that's not the form. That's not the Jewish people. The Jewish people is the Kodesh Kodoshim. It's the Holy of Holies. Where us and Hashem together, where husband and wife are together, them, they and only they, and nobody else. And any suggestion of that relationship, even just a whiff of it, is abhorrent to the Jewish sensitivity. That's why Jewish women know that even to look at a man in the wrong way, it's not what we are. A woman should measure her words when she speaks to him. A man certainly should measure his words when he speaks to him, not more than necessary. Jewish people have a custom that you don't even ask. It's halacha even. You shouldn't even ask a woman how she is, generally speaking. Unless there's a special reason. When people write letters, there's a custom. There's a Jewish custom, halacha. It's brought down in halacha. When a person writes a letter to his friend, he shouldn't send regards to his wife. What are you sending your regards to his wife for? That's not the form. That's not what we do. A person should sign the letter, drishat shalom, mibayit lebayit. That's what people write. Regards from home to home, which means from my wife to your wife. That's what it means. There are many people who are careful when they speak to women to ask, how are you all? How's the family? Not how are you? What are you inquiring about how she is for? The sensitivity that people should generate. The Israeli society, the Israeli religious society has generated this to an extreme degree. American society has taken a more relaxed view of it, Kedusha, but in a different way. I went to Israel recently, 2 or 3 months ago, and I came across a couple, friends of mine. A Yemenite couple. Where this thing is so electric, where this thing is so electrically developed. I used to know as a doctor in that community that I'd have to be very careful when I was walking down the path at night from my home to the shul in that small community. I'd have to be very careful about which woman was walking past me on the path. If she was an American woman, I had to greet her civilly. It would be rude not to greet someone I knew. But if she was an Israeli woman, or certainly a Moroccan or Yemenite woman, even if I treated her intimately as a doctor, as her doctor, I definitely wouldn't greet her. She'd be offended if I would greet her. At night alone, a man should greet her, not a husband. I met this couple walking in the street. I hadn't seen them for 2.5 years. Close friends. We went through a lot of hard times together. A lot of intense times together. And I was walking in the street and unexpectedly I saw the two of them. So we rushed up to each other. And as her husband and I rushed up to each other, she disappeared. She disappeared. That she shouldn't even be there to greet me. I carried her child to hospital one night in the rain while the child was fitting. The child wouldn't stop fitting. I couldn't control the child's fits. A baby. And I carried the child to hospital myself. We went through that together. Dripping in the rain. That worry and that agony. He wouldn't look at me. Not necessary. He'd greet me warmly. That's the condition of the Jewish people. It has to be applied appropriately. It has to be understood. But that's what we are. And when the mood is a mood of levity, like at a wedding, then we're really worried. That's really not the time to be together. The Mishnah says that when you're in a mood of lightheartedness, that's when things really may go wrong. Things may well go wrong. That's why we're so careful. We sit separately. We sit carefully. If you go to a place where you can't do that, at least have the sensitivity. A Jewish person should know to arrange himself around the table in such a way that you sit next to the husband and your wife sits next to his wife and so forth around the table. The social convention has to organize it the other way. If that's the sensitivity of the Jewish people, Why is it organized that way? So you get friendly with her, so you can dance with her, so that's not the way we behave. We take extreme pains in this area, not because we're worried. A person could look at this element of the Jewish people and think that we're lowlier than anybody else. That we're so worried about this area, it must be that we've got this great evil inside of us. Obviously it's not. Has any other nation ever lived up to this? In a vaguely similar way, have they ever even thought about it? Have they ever even tried, even paid lip service to this area? that we've given our lives for. The Jewish women have given their lives for, that they've taught to the Jewish people. Let's understand one final idea to try and put it together. Why is this area so important? Why is this the center of life? Why is this the center of what a person is? And therefore so potent, and therefore the center when your life's being hung in the balance on Yom Kippur, this is the area you focus on. Why is that? How does it work? So briefly, Bajie is as follows. What is the emotion of this pleasure? Again, it's very hard to talk about the details. I'll have to leave it to you to put together. But let's talk as far as we can. What is the emotion? What is the thing? Why is this such a central thing? It's not a pleasure like other pleasures. As we pointed out, society doesn't go around what you eat for breakfast or for dinner. That's not what society goes around. Libraries aren't written about it, as we pointed out. Why? What is this area? As has been pointed out before, a person, every other pleasure's got a limit. There's a limit to other pleasures. A person doesn't plan for 6 months how he's going to have a cigarette after the cholent. A person doesn't do that. For 5 minutes of enjoyment, a person doesn't spend 6 months playing. That's not the way the mind works. But in this area, a person can spend a lifetime. There are people who spend years. There are people who spend years, they'll commit years of intense planning and effort and expense for less than that. Again, it's hard to talk in detail. You have to. These are obvious things. Why is that? What does it mean? What does it mean? Let's start off like this. Let's start this area. In a few minutes, try and see if we can put it together. This area is called Arayas. Arayas means forbidden relationships. Arayot, Arayas. What we read on Yom Kippur, the parashas of Arayas, forbidden relationships. The problem to understand here, the problem is this, that Arayas means sexual relationships that are forbidden. But the name derives from those relationships that are specifically the most forbidden ones, namely relatives. In other words, understand, there's a drive here for a man to relate to a woman in a way that he shouldn't. The name we give that drive is the name of those relationships where a man has no drive. Isn't that strange? The name that we give, yes, a man has a drive to a certain woman. He does not have a drive to be attracted towards his sister or his mother. He doesn't have that. The name of being of the relationship between a man and his sister or a man and his mother is called Arayas. So we use that name to describe this whole attraction. That's very strange. Why isn't it called Tavas Nashim? The drive, the attraction to women. Why is it called Arayas, which means those incestuous relationships? Why that area? But the Kabbalistic understanding of it is a very, very fascinating idea. And again, we don't have time to prove it, and these are things that can't be proved. We'll just state the fact, and a person who's sensitive will feel immediately and be able to put together and crystallize the whole picture immediately. The pleasure in this area, as far as we can talk about it, the pleasure in this area, what's involved in this area, is that what a person experiences here is the experience of freedom. Let's understand this. What the mystics call, what's called in this area, patur. Patur means that you have no obligation. Let's understand well. When a person's engaged in that kind, this area of pleasure, is an area where the sensation is that a person is engaged in something that's its own end. Understand again. When a person eats, a person's eating in order, right, although it's pleasurable, but the food sustains a person so he can go on. But the emotion of this area is that a person's involved in an area that is an end in itself. Not to get you someplace else. That's the ultimate pleasure. The ultimate pleasure is an experience of life for life's own sake. Try to understand this as well as we can. There are two areas in life. There's that which is geared towards tachlis, towards an outcome. That's what we call responsibility, chayv, that I gear myself in to this area of responsibility to achieve the outcome that should come out of this. I relate to you in a way that together we build something, and I do it because I'm responsible to you, and I'm responsible to build this thing. In a broader sense, I'm responsible to Hashem. I'm alive and doing what I'm doing because I have responsibility. Responsibility means to guide and guard and guide my life toward the tachlis, responsibility. Pleasure for its own sake is the exact opposite. The ultimate pleasure in the world, that's pleasure for its own sake, is this area. When a person eats, what's happening is he's sustaining himself, and he's getting the well-being, the sense of well-being and sustenance and strength to keep going. At the same time, it's chocolate-coated. At the same time, it's got honey spread on it. It tastes good also. That's what they say, Ateva Meitiv. Hashem is good and he does good. What's the two expressions? He's good that he gives you food to sustain you, and he does good that it tastes good also. He didn't have to do that. Food could have been in tasteless white powder that you would have had a drive for. But he didn't do it that way. He made it taste good also. But this area between a man and a woman, the sensation that the neshama experiences in this area, understand this carefully, is the sensation of being involved in something that dafka doesn't go anywhere. That this is the tachlis. This, no matter how short-lived or whatever it is, but this experience is the end result. Again, I can't prove this to you. You either know this or you don't. Let's understand why this is so. First of all, let's understand the evil of it. Let's understand the evil of it. When a person drives himself to that area for its own sake, the evil, Rabbi Yerucham of Meir used to put it this way, a genius of a man who used to put it this way. When a mother gives her child bread, this is what he said. Understand this very, very well. The genius in the Muslim movement. He said this. When a mother gives her child a slice of bread because she wants the child to eat the bread, she smears honey on the bread. She's not interested in the honey. She wants the child to eat the bread. The child eats the bread because he likes the honey. The child eats the bread because he wants the honey. The mother's prepared to put up with that. She doesn't mind. The child is eating the bread. You hear what's going on here? Hashem wants a tachlis in the world. He's not interested in your pleasure. He wants a tachlis in the world. Actually, ultimately, all he wants is your pleasure. We'll try and get to that. But what he wants you to earn your pleasure with is responsibility to earn it. He's interested, but he makes it sweet. He makes it taste sweet along the way. So you, at an immature stage, can attach yourself to the sweetness and you'll do the job for him anyway. As you get more mature, you'll focus less on the sweetness and more on the job. But what does a bad child do? You know what a wicked child does? A normal child eats the bread because he wants the honey. You know what a wicked child does? Scrapes off the honey. And he leaves the bread. And he leaves the bread. That's not real. That's not real. Evil children. Evil children, that's not real. Take the pleasure, leave the obligation. That's what we want. We want to scrape off the honey. He's only giving us the honey to do the job for him. We don't want to do the job. We'll block the job. We'll use contra whatever it is all the way. Contra chayv, contra obligation, all the way. That's what we do. We just want the honey, lick off the honey. We don't care about his obligation. That's a wicked child. It's not just a normal child. It's prepared to put up with this because of that. That's what we do. Let's understand further. Why is it that this pleasure is like that? Why is the honey coating thickest in this area? So what they say, the mystics. That everything in the world is coated with honey. The closer to the core, where the job is more important, there's a thicker coating of honey. Where it's more important to Hashem, where it's closer to the essence of what a human being is, so the honey is thicker. Understand this. Let's approach it this way. The Gemara says that there are three entrances to Gehenna. A person can get into hell, into Gehenna, in three ways. One's in the desert, one's in the sea, and one's in Yerushalayim. Three entrances to Gehenna. Understand what this means. Three openings into Gehenna. One's in the desert, which is a place of desolation and waste. One in the sea, which is a place of richness and sensuality, where everything is full and bountiful. And Yerushalayim is a place of Kedusha, mistaken understanding of holiness. That's how a person can kill himself. Not talking about that now. But the sea, place of richness and bounty, where everything is bountiful and plentiful, that's the way a person can get into Gehenna. No, understand. Then the Gemara says in another place, where's the entrance to Shemayim? To Olam Haba. Where, if you wanted to look on earth, understand carefully, where the wonderful depth, understand? Where on earth would a person find the entrance to heaven? Beit Sha'an, says the Gemara. Sha'an, the Sha'an Valley in Israel. Why? Because the fruits there are very sweet. Unreal sweetness to the fruits. Gemara has nothing there about the sweetness of the fruits of the Sha'an Valley in Israel. Unbelievable sweetness. What does that mean? The way to heaven, the way to Gan Eden, the way to Olam Haba is through the pleasure. The area where the pleasure is greatest, you can be sure that's the opening, that's the entrance that a person can get into Gan Eden. A person can get into the next world. Two have to go hand in hand. Why? Because the experience of the next world is only honey. The experience of the next world is not, the bread isn't there in the next world. What's given in the next world is only the honey. What's given in the next world is the experience of no obligation at all. So understand well. The obligation is the bread. The reward is the honey. This world is the obligation, that's all. Spread with honey so you get a taste, so you'll do it. The next world is only the reward. There's no obligation in the next world. The pleasure of the next world, the ecstasy of the next world is that it's only a holiday. The pleasure of the next world is that you don't have to do anything to earn anything. You are that thing. I'm trying to understand this. And why fruits? Because the pleasure of the next world is where the effort is the fruit. Why is it that the fruits of Sha'an are the place of sweetness that leads you into the next world? Because, you understand, the fruit means this area produces fruit. This area between man and woman that a person gets engaged in when he's a wicked child and tries only to scrape off the honey. He gets engaged in that area that's been planning for 6 months of evil. how to get involved in just licking a little honey. But that's the area that should produce fruit. The purpose of this thing is to produce is obligation. It's to do the work that should do the job. This honey spread thick over there because the job's that important. But the next world, there is no job. The next world's our reward. That's the concept of the next world. The concept of this world is that you work on something. The concept of the next world is that you enjoy the result. Just one way we see this. One way we see this is as follows. It says that what happens in the next world? What happens in the next world? We bond with Hashem. What's going on there? What happens? It says we eat a thing called the Leviathan. We eat a Suda. We eat a meal of a fish called the Leviathan. What is this Leviathan? I'm not going to go into what it is now. Just one dimension. It says that Hashem plays with the Leviathan. Hashem in Shemaim, if you want to know what God is doing, he's playing with the Leviathan. That's what it says. Mishta Hashaya ima Leviathan. Mesachek ima Leviathan. He's playing with it. What does it mean Hashem plays with this fish? What does it mean? What does it mean? So understand here. You have patience for another 5 minutes? What is the concept of Sha'ashua? The Hebrew word Sha'ashua meaning to play a game. It's not to play a game. The next world you play games. That's what the next world is. You play a game. It's a place where a person plays games. That's all. That's all you do is play. What's the concept of playing? You have to hear this well. The concept of a game. It's beautiful. You have an example in the world to understand. When a person plays a game, you know what is the definition of a game? Where the activity is the end in itself. Isn't that a game? Anything else you do in the world is to get you someplace else. But when you play a game, it's not going to get you any place. The reason you play a game is just for the enjoyment of playing the game. Is that right? That's what a game is. Sha'ashua, the concept of a game, again, is a unique thing in the world called a game. Where did that come from? Yes? In 10 billion years of evolution of the gorilla to what it is now, where did this thing called a game evolve? What does it mean? Understand? The concept of a game is a human activity, unique thing, that a person does a thing for the sake of doing it. If nothing else, you do that way. Or shouldn't. Of course, you can extract the non-essential from the essential and do everything that way, but it shouldn't be. The purpose of sleeping is to have strength for tomorrow. The purpose of eating a meal is to have strength for today. That's what it should be. But a game isn't for the purpose of anything. I'm not talking about a game to teach a child something. I'm talking about a game that a person relaxes with a game. In Hebrew, the word Sha'ashua is an incredible word. There are no roots like that in Hebrew. Sha'ashua in Hebrew is spelled Sha'asha. That's how it's spelled in Hebrew. Sha' in Hebrew, the word Sha' means to turn towards. You know that? Like it says, Cain and Abel, they brought a gift to Hashem. Well, Minchas Cain lo Sha' says. To the gift of Cain, or to Hebel's gift, Hashem turned. Sha'. Sha' means to turn towards, to orientate myself towards something. You know what Sha'asha means? To turn myself towards, turning towards. That's what it means. That's what it means. That's what the word means. Sha'asha. Not Sha' towards something else, towards his gift, or towards my tachlis, but Sha'ashua. I'm turning, that means that this activity is the end in itself. The word says that. What does it mean Hashem plays in the next world? The next world is a place, there is no place to go. There is no place to go. You're there. There is no place to go. Any place going is out. Therefore, any activity there is for its own sake. What is it going to build? You're in the place of darkness. The whole definition of the next world. That's why it says in the next world the fruit tastes the same as the tree. It says, the Kabbalists say that in the next world, Tama 8 and Tama Pre Shabbat, the taste of the tree and the taste of the fruit is the same. Why? Because the tree brings out a fruit. The purpose of the tree is to produce a fruit. And even that's got a purpose, to produce another tree, to produce another fruit. So the tree is there as a pathway to produce the fruit. But in the next world, there is no pathway to produce. The next world is the fruit. So the next world, the pathway and the fruit is all the fruit. That's what it means. Hashem is playing in the next world. So when a person gets involved in producing life, in that area, where the life energy is closest to the blood, to the neshama of a human being, where the reverberation, the vibrations of a person's own life coming into being are felt. So the emotion that drives a person there, the production of fruit, is the production of the next world. Where a person is doing an activity that has the power to give birth to a human being. So he feels some of the pleasure of the giving birth to himself that exists in the next world. He's involved in making the tree become the fruit. That's a connection between this world and the next. That's why it's irresistible, that area. The reason, I hope you're with me, the reason that area is irresistible. You know what the psychologists say? I don't know. But the reason this area is irresistible is because a person's taking all that he is and he's distilling it into an energy. And that energy is his own being. But it's his own being in producing another of his own being. But nothing more powerful than that. And that is what you're here for, is to produce you and what you should be producing. And the honey is very thick there. Again, it's very hard to... Those are the words. Let he who understands... One who understands, understands. And that's why it's the central pleasure. And that's why it's the core of what a human being is. And when a person gets involved there, he tastes Ganeden. A person experiences the next world. A person experiences the feeling of being involved in something for the sake of being involved in it. That's what it is. That's all it is. And that's intense pleasure. Anatomically, if you want to understand the pleasure neurologically, you want to measure the nerves. So it could be that a sugar cube on your tongue might produce the same nerves, same nerve stimulation. But people don't relate to it that way. You write books about putting sugar on your tongue. Again, libraries about it. Yes? You get more powerful neurological stimulation from all kinds of machines, and there's many ways to get neurological stimulation. It's not the point. It's not the point at all. Therefore, that's the core of what a human being is. And therefore, the Jewish pathway, let's try and put it together and close the circle. The Jewish pathway is to take the area of the human being, that's the core of the human being, where the nature of the experience is this association from obligation, where the drive that the human being has is the drive to get involved in that area for no purpose at all other than the pleasure, and what you experience there is that you've arrived. When a person experiences that area correctly, intensely, what a person understands, what a person senses, the sensation of being involved in that area is the sensation that I'm there, I've arrived. No place to go. The person isn't going any place when he's there. There. If only it could last, that's what a person thinks. But it doesn't, of course. Can't in the finite world. So the Jewish pathway, the Jewish answer, the way we deal with it, what we're here for, we take the area that's non-obligation. The area that's the area of doing a thing for its own sake, and we make it do something. We take that area, that's where we put obligation. Understand carefully. Why is it called Arayas? Why is it called Arayas? Why is this area? It's an amazing Kabbalistic concept. Why do we give the name of attraction to women that a man has, the name of attraction to his sister, where he's not attracted? You know what they say? The mystical explanation? Because if you said that it was an attraction to women, if you gave it the name, let's understand this, and a mind-boggling concept. If you gave it the name of attraction to women whom he's allowed to be attracted to, or to most women, so there'd still be obligation, but not to those. If you gave this drive a name of attraction to women, that means that a man would want to get involved with women, or women. But there's a category of women that he's not allowed to get involved with, his mother, his sister. Some place of forbidden. So then there's obligation already. This yes and that not. It's already a mechanism of obligation. But the whole nature of this area is that it's complete and utter freedom. So we call it by the name of exactly that area where there's not even a desire to get involved, to express the idea that the essence of this thing is its non-limitation. A very, very deep idea. We call it by the name of that area which expresses the ultimate expanse of this area, which means no limitation at all. If a person would get really stuck into that area completely, he would want his consciousness of obligation and what yes and what not to dissolve entirely. Don't bother me with that. I'm there. Don't bother me with the distinctions who yes and who not, and when yes and when not, and how yes and how not. Now give me obligations. This is life. That's the nature of that. So Jewish people, we don't do that. We take that area, which is the most important area, it's the Yom Kippur area, it's the area of what a person is, and we give our lives to channel that into obligation. A husband for his wife, and only for his wife. In the correct way, the way of obligation. The Balei Musa say that a person can be with his wife and it can be arayas. A person can be with his wife, it can be arayas, it can be immoral. If he's relating to it for himself, if he's in this area for himself, that's arayas. He's experiencing the next world now, because no place else to go. He's not doing this for his love and obligation towards her and what's being built, or what's coming out of it, or what's being developed out of this area. Or he's doing it because of the responsibilities involved here, in responsibilities, building something in life, to answer to a creator who expects him to review something. He's taking time out now to be what he wants to be for his own sake. Doesn't matter if it's his wife or not. That's the nature of the Jewish people. We take this area, that's the most potent ordeal and temptation that a person has. That's death to a person. That's what this area is. That Western culture has unashamedly made the core of what they are and advertised itself blatantly in such bad taste at every turn. And we take that and we prepare to give our lives not even to look in the wrong direction. To make Kedusha without even not, never mind looking in the wrong direction. That a woman should be uncovered is worth going through torture, that a woman shouldn't be immodestly uncovered. And what have we sunk to? We've sunk to a level where what we're trying to do is expose that area. Where a woman will think all year, never, a Jewish girl now, brought to the situation where instead of giving her life, that rather she should pin her dress to her legs rather than be exposed, where it's not her fault at all. She'll spend all year thinking what she's going to eat so she can uncover herself at the end of the year on the beach. That's abhisanti. And that's beauty. That's called beauty. That's called beautiful. That's all this beauty. It will help you make it beautiful. That's not the church.
So, what we have to work on in Yom Kippur is understanding that you have to take the area. When a person rises to the level that they can actually experience who they are, Yom Kippur, you don't have a yetzer. The body doesn't speak on Yom Kippur. You step out of the body on Yom Kippur. You don't connect to the physical. You step out of your shoes on Yom Kippur. Mystics say that you step out of the lowest level of physicality. Not even your shoes hold you anymore. The sunken part of the body that's connected to the ground, you don't even lock into the ground. You step out of that. Shoes are called locks in Hebrew. Do you know that? Nal in Hebrew is a lock that locks you in. You step out of the body. You step out of the food dimension. You step out of... What are the five things you're not allowed to do on Yom Kippur? What are the five things? Eat and drink. Wear shoes. Anoint the body. All the body. And marital relations. That's what it is. You step out of that. When a person steps out of that, and they're a raw, naked neshama, they can actually look at themselves honestly that year. That's why it says 364 days, hasatan in Hebrew, add up the satan, the negativity that surrounds a person, the evil drives, the physicality that a person has, adds up to 364. Why? Because there's one day of the year when it doesn't apply. There's no power. Which day is that? Yom Kippur, obviously. You step right out of it. You aren't in your body, so what's going to tempt you? The body isn't there on Yom Kippur. Where's the body on Yom Kippur? You left him behind. When you extract yourself from the body on Yom Kippur, and you look at yourself as a raw neshama, and you understand, tachlis, you're looking at what you're here for. Are you here for your own sake, that you turn towards, turning until you finally fade out? Or are you here for a sense of obligation? That means the most intimate power of a person's life, which is being able to produce fruit, which is himself, his own being, her own being, and what they're building in the world, in relationships, in family, in everything that you're trying to build. That's the focus of Yom Kippur. The energy that's focused in there is the area of this area. The energy of this area, this intimate area, which is the area, the energy that produces life. It's that energy that a person focuses on Yom Kippur. And that's why we read the Parsha Baras on Yom Kippur. What's forbidden and how to make it obligation. Never mind that it's his wife, his sister, whatever it is. Because that's exactly where that area operates, without any limitation. That's what you take and you give that area in. The motivation for all motivations in the world. You give that into obligation. You take that energy, where the temptation of the energy is to do and be involved in that area for its own sake. You channel that into obligation. So then if a person does that, a person could live for the next generation.